Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our guest today is Monique Allen. She is a landscape designer, a contractor, fine gardener, and the founder and creative director of The Garden Continuum. And she has a new book out. It's called Stop Landscaping, Start Lifescaping. So we'll talk with her about her book. We'll get some advice on how to add edible plants to your existing landscape. Monique Allen with us by phone. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Well, I tell you what, you've been involved in gardening for, wow, over 35 years, I guess. Talk about how you got interested in it.
You know, I got interested in it as a teenager. I was about 18 and very lost, really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And a friend of mine said, hey, why don't you come mulching with us? And I looked at him like, what, you want me to do what? And, you know, I went and did it, and I had always been very active and athletic, and it was like coming home. And I never looked back. From 18 years old, I just never looked back.
Well, I love the introduction to your book, because you go into a little bit of detail on it. And I really like how you think about gardening. When you were talking in that introduction about you and your prospective husband, I think at the time, looking for a house, but you really were interested in the property around the house.
Yeah, the poor realtor. The poor guy, he was so confused, because we just sort of glanced at the house, and then, because it's 2.5 acres, we wanted to walk the land. And the poor guy is standing there, and he has no idea how to help us. And, you know, ultimately we thought, you know, I knew the inspector, and we figured, look, if there's anything wrong with the house, he's going to tell us. But the truth is, houses can be fixed. It's kind of easy. But land, I mean, you want to try to fix land or change land, you're talking about a lot of money. And so we wanted the land to be right. We had a big vision about how we were going to live. So we needed to walk that 2.5 acres.
Oh, man. And a lot of work over many a year.
Yes, still going on. Hence lifescape, right? Because it's not like, it's not a one and done.
But I like the fact that you were kind of proud of the fact that I think it was your daughter wanted to have her wedding ceremony taking place on your own property, because she thought it was a beautiful.
Yeah, well, we're talking about it seriously because, you know, everything is closed right now, and she's set to be married in October. And so we've been talking about, you know, do we use our front yard? And it's kind of cool to be able to even consider that as an option.
How has the whole COVID business affected your business?
It's been very interesting. You know, I'm nicely connected. I'm a legislative liaison for the Massachusetts Landscapes Professionals Organization, and we've got a group called the GIA, the Green Industry Alliance. So as soon as we knew that landscape wasn't really called out as essential, we wanted to clarify that. And so we have a lobbyist, we're connected with the National Association, and we did a lot of work to very, very quickly mobilize and get the governor of Massachusetts and also the federal government to say that outside work, provided we were being incredibly safe, would be possible. So while our offices are closed and we have a rotating schedule to allow people in them, we are working, not fully, because we have to only have one person in a truck and things like that, but we're working. So we feel very blessed.
Yeah, that's one of the bright spots, I guess, if you could call it that, that at least those folks like yourself who are out doing landscaping, gardening kinds of work can do it. And frankly, there's ways to do it safely.
There are definitely ways to do it safely. And I'll tell you, one of the other things that's been so great is that our connections with our clients have been heightened this year because they're around. and their interest and their desire to do a little work on their own. You know, we went to one client's house and we planted up some planters in the front of her house, and that's all we usually ever do. And she asked us if we'd give her extra plants because she was going to plant more on her own. And we thought that was fabulous. We just delivered the plants.
That's a great story. Well, tell us about your book. Who's your audience for your book?
So my audience, I have a kind of a double audience. The first audience is homeowners, really people who are extremely interested in their land and their home to be connected, and just a really nice inflow between the energy of nature and all the effort they're doing to make their house nice. So it really is for people who want to kind of do it like what I did, buy a piece of land, update your house, update your land, make it yours, live there for the long haul. It'll work really well for that kind of reader because it helps to demystify the process and to move it from, you know, a thing to a long-term process. So it's not just, oh, it's a project, we'll do this, we'll get it done. And then I am also tapping landscape professionals because the industry has gotten very commoditized. And I think if we look hard at ways to build relationships as a part of building landscapes, I think even landscape professionals are going to have a way better experience if they adopt the LifeScape method.
If you, as you look at, whereas a homeowner looks at his or her property or their property, you know, just how to envision
The visioning part is very interesting, and I go into this in detail in the book, and one of the chapters is called Dare to Dream. And one of the things that I've found, you know, I have this silly, long subtitle, A Guide to Ending the Rush, Rush, Humdrum Approach to Landscape Development and Care. And the issue is that, you know, when we learn about landscape as a makeover, we expect it to be a turnkey, quick, one-and-done kind of thing. But when we're really talking about developing a lifescape, which is very similar to getting a puppy and raising an amazing animal that becomes an awesome companion, that takes an enormous amount of effort. So, but it's not effort that's drudgery. You enjoy it. And so I'm trying to embrace this idea of the dreaming process is part of it. Being able to be out there and ask yourself, what would make me really, really happy? What would make me really, really satisfied? And I'll tell you right now, using edibles in our landscape is a way to have immediate satisfaction because every single part of the process is satisfying.
So are you talking about a vegetable garden, or are you talking about working it in among other plants that that you have?
Yes and yes. both. So I have personally been vegetable gardening for as long as I can remember. And back when I started in the landscape industry, you know, I lived in an apartment and I had a deck in the back. I was in a three-decker house. And what I did was I attached window boxes all around the three outside railings of my deck. And I planted all manner of herbs in those and small vegetables like lettuce. And then I put pots right on my balcony, and I was able to grow cucumbers and tomatoes. And one of the things about smaller landscapes where you're going to grow vegetables is you really want to think about growing up instead of out, you know, using trellises and things like that. So that was my introduction. And but then when I ended up with land, you know, I had a full-on section of my landscape that was like a farm. But I'll tell you, I don't have it anymore because I'm of a certain age. My lower back hurts. It's hard, you know. So now I have boxes that are 25 inches high. So you really, the beautiful thing about incorporating edibles into your landscape, whether you're incorporating them into an organic garden, and that is a really important thing to stress, is that if you are going to incorporate plants into your gardens have to be organic, of course, right? You don't want to be using things like preen and, you know, all sorts of chemicals. But you can have it in lots of different ways, and it can evolve as you grow, right? So you're going to do it one way if you're doing it by yourself, one way if you have little kids, one way if you're doing it on the fly, and another way if you're getting up there in years and need to protect your lower back.
Yeah, absolutely. Monique Allen, our guest today, a landscape designer, founder, and creative director of the Garden Continuum. And her new book is called Stop Landscaping, Start Lifescaping. And let's take a call. Marcus in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. So I do remodeling and construction. I also end up doing some landscaping from time to time for my customers. And basically what I've found from this whole corona thing, very much what your guest is talking about, is that due to time and financial constraints, whatever, people are taking a step back from the I want it done yesterday. And I'm actually able to have more substantive conversations with my customers and develop more of like a landscape, whether it's in the home or outside. And I feel like people are just returning to a more pragmatic sensibility. And, you know, it's I think it's an interesting change, and I'd like to see where this goes.
Oh, Marcus, thank you for calling. Comment, Monique.
I think that is just so exciting for me to hear, because I think that I struggle with the same things that builders and remodelers struggle with, and that is the impatience of our client. And we're trying so hard to take good care of them, because anyone who decides to become a builder, whether it's of landscapes or of homes, really has a passion for creating where we live. And that takes thought and it takes patience. And just like Marcus said, it requires these conversations that iterate, right? So if I have a conversation with you on Wednesday and then I go home and I have dinner and I talk to my spouse and I go to sleep, I wake up, I may wake up going, I have an idea. And then you want to call Marcus and have a conversation about that. And that might tweak the, you know, what you end up doing. And so when you allow it to evolve a little bit over time, it allows our brains to process each element of the project so that you are, in fact, respecting the process. So I think what he's experiencing is just so heartwarming to hear.
Marcus, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dan in Racine, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you guys doing this morning? I am listening to your program, and I have a wonderful idea for more than one person on a job site. First of all, gas is cheap. Second of all, the landscaper or contractor can buy magnetic signs. So you have your employees. One person drives a truck with the equipment on it. The other one shows up to the drive to the site with their own truck or car. They have a magnetic sign on it. It says they're part of the landscaping crew or a construction crew. Then they can all work apart from one another, and then they can reimburse the people for their mileage on their truck because gas is cheap today. So I think that's a better way to go to a job site.
Ah, Dan, thanks for calling. Monique, is that a procedure you use?
Yeah, it's actually exactly what we're doing. So we have, in order to keep things clean and safe, we're trying very hard on a weekly basis to assign a crew leader to a truck. And, you know, we've got different levels of trucks, some that pull equipment, some that pull trailers, and then people bringing their own cars. And to make it really easy, you know, we have no traffic. I mean, there's no school buses, very few people commuting. So we've gone from, you know, starting at the crack of dawn to starting just like a half hour later than we normally do. And we're still on the job at the same time. And then we're able to separate the workers. We are trying to be really careful about having too many different companies on a property at the same time, because we've had to put extremely rigorous safety protocols in play, and you don't know what the other companies are doing. So we've tried really hard with our partner companies to just communicate in such a way that our plant healthcare people are there different days than we're there. And if there's a contractor, let's say painting, we're trying to understand their schedule. And then if they're painting up front, we're working in the back. So that's worked out really well. And I think, again, going back to Marcus's comment about communication, I even think contractors and vendors are communicating more than they usually do.
I think you're right about that. Dan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Monique Allen, our guest today, author of Stop Landscaping, Start Lifescaping. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer. Jane Rotunda. Rachel Vasquez, our on-air producers today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you, my friend, are listening to the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. Great to have you for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and my guest is Monique Allen, landscape designer, contractor, fine gardener, talking with her about her book. It's called Stop Landscaping, Start Lifescaping, and talking about creating an edible garden in any space. Wendy in Appleton, Wisconsin, emailed to ask if you have suggestions for plants that do well in south-facing corners of, you know, a corner that's created by a house and garage, for example.
Yeah, so what I would, you know, I'm not sure if she's talking about vegetable gardens or regular, you know, ornamental plants, but one of the things that she's asking, which is, I think, important to press on, is that what she's talking about is how do you plant in a microclimate? So your area, I think, is around a 5B. I'm in like 6A. So what will happen is in that particular pocket she's talking about, she's going to go up a notch or two in her zone. So the cool thing is if you have trouble growing a certain plant in the 5B climate, now in that pocket she could look at a 6A or a 6B plant because it's going to be warmer even in the winter. Right. So when deciding, that's where you can kind of have fun. So if you have, for instance, trouble with lilacs, that's going to be a place that will grow lilac really well. If you have trouble with roses because you have winter dieback all the time, you might do better there with roses. Then if you want to look at the vegetables, things like your squashes, they all need really, really warm soil. So she could put the black fabric down and warm up the soil because it's a warm pocket and have really, really great luck with something like a summer squash. So that's the way to look at it.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Let's take another call. Keith in Kewanee, it's your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I recently read a book on regenerative agriculture by Gabe Brown and talks about the soil biology being really important to grow healthy crops and things. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas for, like, multi-species of vegetables and herbs that you can grow together that so that, you know, one supports the other. Also, I have a question about if you have, you know, lawn that you want to turn into some garden, but you don't want to plow up the whole lawn. Do you have ideas for, like, strip planting of vegetables or herbs in lawns that would be easy to harvest? And I'll take your comments off the radio. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Keith. Monique?
Yeah.
Couple of things here.
Sure. So right off the bat, it makes me think of a great movie called The Need to Grow. I don't know if you've seen it. It was put out by the Food Revolution, but it's really, really wonderful because it talks about regenerative agriculture and the fact that we need very lively soil, right, with good soil biology, teeming with microbes. That's a book, actually, which is a very good book. And so making sure, I mean, that's where we have to start. We always have to start with the soil. Oftentimes people are really concerned about what plant should I use. Plants, you know, they want to grow. It's part of their DNA. They want to grow. So if you give them a really good growing medium, they're going to do really well. So I highly recommend that movie, The Need to Grow. You can Google it. It's all over the internet. I think you can get the movie for like $7 and have it for yourself. As far as crop companion planting, I will say that, you know, the nitrogen fixing plants, so all of the plants in the legume family, they will nitrogen fix. So if you have a row of peas on trellises in the back of your garden, and then in the front of that, let's say you put beets, and then in the front of that, you put arugula, now you've got a really nice kind of using the air niche with your peas growing up, using the soil niche with your beets growing down, and then using that middle niche with your arugula, the lettucey growing kind of in that mid niche. So I'm a real proponent. I love the idea of layering. That's just awesome. About his idea about taking up the lawn, there's actually a great little video on Gardener's Supply, which is actually a website that I love because there's a lot of really good resources. And you could just Google, like, I think it's Gardener's Supply, putting in your first vegetable garden. And they talk about taking out sections of your lawn. So all you need to do is take out a small section of the lawn. I recommend a minimum of 3 feet wide and, let's say, 6 feet long. Anything smaller than 3 feet, your lawn's going to keep wanting to come back in. The nice thing about 3 feet is if you're kneeling on one side, you can reach the other side. If you go to 4 feet, then you want to be able to garden from both sides, you know? And then the only caution that I'm going to put out there is that if you are gardening ground level right next to your lawn, you just need to make sure that your lawn is 100% organically managed.
Oh, yeah, that makes good sense for sure. Keith, thank you for that question. Appreciate it. John in West Alice emailed to ask, what food plants would you suggest for containers on his, he has a south-facing patio and wonders about vegetables that might work there or food plants.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you right away, tomatoes in pots work really well. So tomatoes love to be hot. They need to be well watered, but they also don't mind sort of a lot of heat in their soil. So tomatoes always work well, and it's very easy, especially things like all of the cherry tomatoes and pear tomatoes. They grow really, really well. Some of the smaller cucumbers, peppers, as well as eggplants, also very easy because you can put them in cages and they'll grow up. The nice thing with that is you can companion plant. So if you have a big enough pot and you have a tomato in the center, why not wrap it with basil, right? Because what's more yummy than tomato and basil? another really fun thing to do, which I love, is I love nasturtiums. You can actually eat the flowers. They're a bit spicy. And so if you're planting in pots, the nice thing about the nasturtiums, if you plant them around the outside, then they spill over and flow over the edges. So you've got your vegetable growing up and your nasturtiums growing down. So one of the things that I just want to make sure all of your callers know is they should feel totally empowered to practice, to play, and to test. This is the wonderful thing about vegetable gardening. The plants are very inexpensive, so you don't have to worry that you break it, you know, or do it too wrong. You definitely experiment and keep a log and write down your experiments. So something that doesn't work, big red line through it. Something that works great, I'm going to do that again. So that's just a great way to have fun with it.
And when you, couple of questions just to follow up on that. In terms of pots, what kind of pots do you like for those kinds of situations?
Personally, I like either plastic pots, a resin pot. You can use stone, but stone and terracotta, you have to remember that these are porous. And so the water, if it's very, very hot, a terracotta pot is going to dry out because it's going to wick the water out of the soil. And so if you don't have the ability to water consistently in small measure, just never letting the soil totally dry out, you want to be careful about using terracotta. Stone will also wick, but it's slower than the clay. There are many, many planters now out there that have watering reservoirs. the problem that I see with them, they're great, but the problem I see with them is that people think, oh, now I don't have to water, which is not the case. It actually takes 4 to 6 weeks for a plant to really get its roots long enough that it can access the reservoir. So those are great. Just remember that you are still on watering duty until the plant has matured in that particular pot. And if you're interested in growing things like potatoes, there are these really cool bags that you can grow potatoes in, and they're kind of like a fabric bag. And those are great because you can roll the bag down, start your potatoes, and then as the potato foliage grows up, you just roll up the bag and then add a little bit more soil, and you get deeper rooted, bigger potatoes. So those are some of my favorites.
Yeah. And then in terms of soil for the plants and the planter, what do you normally like to use in pots?
So in pots, I usually will put a little bit of potting soil in my mix just to make sure my mix doesn't get too dense in a pot. So I'll use two parts organic soil, which like I often use like a Coast of Maine organic, but any organic soil that you can get. And then I mix it with one part potting soil so it has a little bit of lightness to it. If you have access to biochar that you can put into the mix of organic material, that can be really good because it really helps to retain moisture and soil biology. And then for fertilizing, I really like to use things like Neptune's Harvest or some kind of biostimulant or bioinoculant just to keep things really nice and healthy. And I tend to stay away from the things like Miracle-Gro or 10-10-10, which no problem for annuals. If I'm growing flowers, Miracle-Gro every day because I'm looking for a lot of flowers. But when I'm looking to grow things I'm eating, I'm really trying to go all organic.
Let's take another call. Sue in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Monique. I'm calling up to ask about potassium source. I have my soil test in front of me, and my potassium level is fine, but my phosphorus is high, but my potassium level is sufficient, but yet the soil test people said I needed to add more potassium. And I've heard of rock dust or a granite dust or pond silt, and I don't seem to find much information about that, so I'm thinking potash is what I have to use to increase the potassium.
What do you think, Monique?
Yeah, I've used Espoma potash. So Espoma brand does make a potash, and you can buy it in like a 6-pound bag, and you can usually buy it online. So that could work really well. If you can get a biochar source, and if you can use something like Neptune's Harvest, you will start to add a broader biological spectrum of nutrients. I'm not surprised that your phosphorus is high. We find phosphorus high in just lots and lots of soils.
Everywhere,
yeah. But Espoma potash is a product I've had good luck with.
All right. Sue, does that help?
Ash, I heard you couldn't just use wood ash from your fireplace. Really need to have a source that can tell you how much, you know, is in it. They vary greatly by different trees that are burned.
Yeah. Absolutely. And if you're ever going to use ash, our recommendation there is that you're mixing that ash into a compost pile, making sure the ash is absolutely dry. It's not hot anymore. And then letting it compost down, and then you can test your compost pile. But now you're talking about applying the ash in year one, composting, turning, testing in the beginning of year two, and then determining whether you can, in fact, use that. But I would never directly add wood ash from a fireplace into a garden because you might spike in one direction or another.
All right. Sue, I thank you very much for calling. Denny called, couldn't stay online, but he's wondering if you've had experience with jumping worms, we are in the Madison, Wisconsin area. I think we're the jumping worm capital almost, it seems like, as there's there are jumping worms everywhere. And I don't know if you have them out there.
We do. We have them terribly. Last year was a particularly bad year for them. They're the Asian crazy worm. I think it's Amynthus agrestis is the Latin name for that worm. And they like to stay on the surface, and they really like wet conditions. And so what we realized here, and I don't know how it was in your area, but we had successive wet. We had a really wet fall that was followed by a really wet spring, and then we had high water tables. And we found that the areas where the worms were the most proliferating were around where they had easy water source, number one. Number two, they had very easy access to top leaf litter because, unlike the other worms, the European worms, which will they'll hunker down into the soil, this worm is consuming very quickly leaf litter. And we were using a lot of leaf mulch and so decided that we would move away from leaf mulch for a year or two and use a woodier bark mulch to help work with them. To diminish them. We also started to add biochar, so we really are looking at how to use biochar as a source to help to maintain the soil biology a little bit better, because what these worms are doing is they're degrading the soil consistency, so it almost looks like coffee grounds, like where they yeah. are proliferating. And yeah. so we realized that we have to add organic matter, we have to add biology, and in order to stabilize that organic matter in biology, we're looking to biochar. Though I have to tell you, biochar is really hard to find. And so we're racing around right now trying to learn as much as we can about it so that we can buy it and incorporate it into our compost.
Well, they're a plague for sure.
They're crazy.
Well, here's another plague. I've got another one for you. A listener emailed to ask if you have had experiences keeping rabbits from eating plants in the garden in the wintertime. They've been eating her grapevines. She doesn't want to chase them away. I don't know why she doesn't. But anyway, is there something she can grow that would taste better than the vines to the rabbits?
Well, I mean, she could develop a taste for rabbit stew. I mean, that's one way. Okay. Rabbits, they're also just, they're so hard. They're so cute. And it just doesn't seem fair that something so cute can be so damaging. At least the crazy worms aren't cute. But I would say that if she has an active grapevine, she's probably getting the rabbits eating the cambium because it's a moisture, it's a water source for them. So I absolutely would get a metal mesh and I would protect, just physical barrier, the base of all of her grapevines to keep them away. That's number one. You can use, like we often will use, believe it or not, Irish Spring soap, and we'll use it like with a cheese grater and just grate it. We use it oftentimes on our tulip bulbs to keep the rabbits away. I will tell you that at my house, I've had, and I know not everybody would want to do this, but it's what I've done, is that I've added Dutch white clover to my lawn, which is one of their favorite foods. And oftentimes I'll see rabbits out in the lawn eating the clover because they love that and not attacking my plants. And then one last thing that I've done is I've planted fennel with a lot of the plants that the rabbits like, because they don't like the fennel. So the same reason they don't like the Irish Spring soap, remember that a rabbit is an animal of prey and they rely on their noses and those big ears to tell them if a predator is coming. And if all they can smell is Irish Spring soap or all they can smell is fennel, they can't smell their predator. And so by putting more pungent things in the garden with stronger scents, you can often push the rabbits into a different direction.
That's a good reasoning for that. No one had explained about why Irish spring soap works, and that makes a lot of sense to me, Monique.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Well, Barb and Elkhorn, your turn. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi, Barb. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Hi. Sorry, I thought I lost you. We recently moved to a new house in November, and there's a farm field behind us, cornfield, and my lawn has been treated previously, and I just wondered, is it better to make a raised bed, or should I wait to do a ground-level garden?
That's a great question. I would do raised. If it were me, I would want it raised up at least, I would say, like 16 inches. Again, Gardener's Supply, they make a great box that you can assemble really easily and get the plants up. I think you want to continue to be mindful of spray drift because if that cornfield is being sprayed, it will drift in the wind. And so the placement of your box would be really important. So I would spend some time in your soil and your site analysis. I talk a lot about site analysis in the book. You want to think about where are the prevailing winds? How are they coming off of the fields? And can you move your vegetable garden into a protected spot so that those prevailing winds aren't hitting it? So that would be another thing that I would think of in addition to raising the bed up off the ground.
I was reminded of my parents' home when they moved to their new home. They had a cornfield that ran along their backyard. They knew the farmer, and the farmer, it was field corn, but for four rows that was next to my parents' property, he would put in sweet corn every year, four rows of sweet corn, and they could then have sweet corn, and it was for them. So, and the other neighbors down the line, and everybody enjoyed sweet corn from that farmer who put in four rows of sweet corn, and then he started his field corn.
That's a great idea.
Well, it was certainly the neighborly thing to do.
Yeah.
For sure. Our guest today, Monique Allen, landscape designer, gardener, and her new book is called Stop Landscaping, Start Lifescaping. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Monique Allen, landscape designer, fine gardener, and author of Stop Landscaping, Start Lifescaping. And we have some callers online. Let's go back to the phones. Nancy in Cross Plains has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I have a hillside that's pretty steep that you can't mow it, and we planted about 15 years ago some cedar bushes, and they got that fungus that affects pine trees and cedars.
Cedar rust.
Yeah, and then anyway, last winter when we had that horrible cold spell, it affected them, and they all seem to be dying out now. Is there something I could put on that hill that would grow quickly? Was no, you know, really low maintenance because of the location.
So you want something that a shrub or were you a ground cover? Were you thinking, Nancy?
Well, either one, something that, you know, if it's a shrub, something. I know we've got low growth sumac; those work really well in another spot, but we were kind of wanting something different. So if there's the ground that grows fast and doesn't spread other places, or
is it a sunny spot or on this hillside?
It's sunny. It faces east. It gets probably 6 to 7 hours of sun a day.
Okay. Monique, any ideas?
Yeah, I have a couple, and it's, Nancy, so cool that you said grow low sumac, because that was the first thing that came into my mind was grow low sumac. We have a amazing slope in Providence, Rhode Island at a commercial site right above a riverway filled with grow low sumac, and it is so beautiful, especially when it turns that gorgeous fire engine red. You know, if you want bigger plants and you do have that much sun, you could stay in the sumac family and look at tiger eyes. I don't know if you've ever seen that sumac, but it's a golden leaf form of the cutleaf staghorn sumac. It just has this incredibly beautiful chartreuse green color, and then the stems are kind of like a rosy pink, so the contrast is really, really nice and can be done in mass, planted in mass, really good with poor soils, definitely would help with erosion. So that could be, because you already know that in your area you can grow sumac really well, that could be stunning. And you could mix it with the grow low sumac, where you are using the height in the middle, maybe staggered through the whole middle like a wave of this beautiful chartreuse yellow, and then on the bottom and the top, put a single wave of the grow low sumac, and now you've got this incredible contrast between the yellow with the pink stems and then the green, which then will turn red. It could be stunning.
Oh, it sounds great. Nancy, what do you think?
I think it sounds really good, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Cherie in West Bend. Hi, Cherie.
Hi. I've been trying to grow marigolds from seeds, and I can't get them to start.
Ooh.
Starting marigold.
So I have a question. Why grow them from seed instead of from starts?
I don't know. I just collect the seeds from the year before.
Okay. So one thing I would want to know right off the bat is if the marigolds that you're collecting them from are sterile, or if they're if they could be GMO seeds that won't germinate. So that could be part of what the issue is. But normally, like we're able to get them to grow pretty easily. I often use Tagetes. I'm trying to think the one that I use, and I'm usually able to grow them right in the soil. Are you trying to grow them in pots ahead of time?
Yeah.
Gosh, I wish I had a good answer for you. I don't know, because usually marigolds will seed really quite quickly. So it could be that the seeds you're collecting for some reason aren't going to germinate, and the thing to do is to buy yourself a seed packet.
Yeah, I think that might be the way to go. I agree with you, Monique. I think that could be the problem there. So a seed packet of marigolds isn't, I'm just trying to think what they cost these days. It's not too expensive, for sure.
Yeah, like anywhere from $2.99 to $4.99, something like that. And you could, if you really want to go with an organic seed or a type of seed that
is from a seed saving bank, you know, someplace like Johnny Selected Seeds. There's some really, really great organizations that are seed saving, and they have that same mission that it sounds like you have, which is to is to save seeds.
So speaking of seeds, what, if any, restrictions should folks consider with gardening in light of coronavirus? For example, we recently received a question from an anonymous listener as part of our Why Wisconsin project, and they heard that we're not allowed to plant seeds at this time, and they're wondering if that's true. Is there anything to worry about? I don't think there is.
I don't think there is. I mean, most seed starting happens inside. I mean, you know, you all are in a colder environment than I am, so I would start my seeds inside or by early starts. I have like a great farm near me called White Barn Farm, and I just sort of wait with bated breath until they get their organic starts, which are, you know. But I don't know of any reason why you couldn't start seeds right now.
All right. So there's your answer. And by the way, just as an aside, as you're listening in, you could submit your questions or concerns about COVID-19 to go to our WPR.org/COVID, and we'll do our best to answer those questions. So that was one of those questions I think we dealt with. Okay. Janet in Warren, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Janet.
Good morning. Yes, my husband is a beekeeper. We're not a large operation, but one of the things we also do is land restoration, taking some very abused land and turning it back into woodlands and prairies. So as beekeepers, one of the things that we try to encourage folks to do is plant things that we know that if you're buying at a big box store or even just a regular nursery, things that are native and things that are neonicotinoid free, so that you don't have that systemic insecticide in your plants.
Yeah.
If you have natives, you're going to have lots of little caterpillars and things for your songbirds to eat, and you'll see more beautiful birds in your yard.
Janet, thanks very much for calling. Monique, you'd agree with that, I bet.
I agree with it so much, and because I work in construction, I see really damaged soils often, and cover cropping is such a great idea for soil restoration. You know, everything from oats to clovers, at trying to nitrogen fix, also trying to get the kind of plants that have tap roots that would be natural aerators of compacted soils. And I think if you can take damaged soils and prairieize them so that they've got a lot of diversity in there, then exactly like Janet says, now all of your pollinators, not just bees, will have a protected source, not only for eating in the stage that we like to look at them, but, you know, especially with butterflies and moths, being able to protect the larval stage and the caterpillar stage. I think it's a really, really great idea, and that feeds really well into slowing down, right? So if you've got a plot of land and you just built a house on it, you might consider cover cropping a portion of it, and then cutting and turning that cover crop as a green mulch back into the soil in order to really build that soil biology. So it's an amazing thing for people to do soil remediation and soil protection. I think it's really cool.
And native plants and
native neonicotinoids. Yep.
Yes. Thank you, Janet. Dan in Mosinee, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me on. Couple questions. One has to do with horseradish. I have horseradish plot and it goes to seed. Do you know, I've never tried growing the seeds, if it will grow from seed? That's the first question. The other question, I'm looking for ground cover plants or grass for an area near a house that I don't want to mow. Where's a good reference to go to find that kind of seed? And if you're not looking at buying 50 pounds, is there some place where you could purchase it?
All right. We've got a brief time to answer here, Monique. Go ahead.
Yeah, so first off, I'm just going to fess up to the fact that I have never grown horseradish, and I have no idea if you can grow it from seed, so I apologize right at the get-go. Number two, if you want a ground cover to be in an area that you don't mow, I would highly recommend looking at plug planting. A place like North Creek Nursery will grow plants in plugs, and plugs are really inexpensive, easy to get in the ground, easy to start, and then you don't have to mow.
That's good, too, and be careful about planting horseradish wherever you plant it because it grows like a weed. Monique Allen, our guest today, landscape designer, contractor. Her new book is called Stop Landscaping, Start Livescaping. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here talking about making the most out of your garden space with our guest, Monique Allen, landscape designer, contractor, gardener, founder, and creative director of the Garden Continuum. It's an award-winning landscape design, build, and fine gardening company. She also has a new book out we've been talking about as well. It's called Stop Landscaping, Start Livescaping. We had a call from Jackie who couldn't stay online, Monique. She lives in an apartment on second floor. She only has north-facing exposure. She's wondering what, if any, vegetables or flowers can grow in this space.
So I would start out with, if it's north-facing, I think the question is how much light do you have? Because you could be north-facing and have zero light. And then that's not going to work. The one thing about food crops is that we really do need a good amount of sun for them. But things like some of the herbs and some of the lettuces and so forth, you can do with less sun than, let's say, your tomato plants or the ones that just need a whole lot more heat. So step one is to determine in that north-facing exposure, is there any light at all? Number two would be to consider a grow station. So there are these really beautiful, small, compact, apartment-sized grow stations that you can buy that have their own light and then a tray right below it to put your herbs, and then below that a little water receptacle so that you can water easily without making a mess. And I think that's a great option. Actually, I grow my wheatgrass in my garage under a grow light, and because I can grow it year round. So I think leaning into some of those apartment dweller without access to sun, some of those are really, really great ideas because then she can have thyme and basil and parsley right at her fingertips.
Yeah, makes very good sense. Tom in Windsor has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning. I have a question. I recently purchased a smoker for smoking meat, and so now I'm having wood ash. Right now it's all oak. Where is it okay to just sprinkle it wherever, like across the lawn, or is there specific things I should or should not do with it, I guess, is my question.
So my recommendation with wood ash is that you want to incorporate it into either a compost pile or into compost and not use it directly into your garden, because remember that it's going to be very porous. And so its first action is going to be to soak all of the life and biology up from where you're putting it into its structure. So first off is to mix it either with a potted compost or if you have compost, mix it up and allow it to basically become inoculated with some of the biology that is in that compost, and then maybe let it stay like that for about a month before you would then incorporate it. That way you're incorporating far less wood ash, but you are also that structure along with the biology of the inoculant, the compost, will go together to make a really good bed amendment. I'm not sure I would put it on lawn. That might be a little bit too much, but if it cooked for a long time in the compost, then you could put like a quarter inch layer and work it into your lawn in the fall when you're amending or reseeding.
All right. Does that help, Tom?
Thank you. It does. All right. It certainly does. You guys have a good day.
You as well. Thanks so much for calling. Pat in Madison emailed to say she has two window boxes. They're 3 feet long, 6 inches deep, 8 inches wide, located on the south side. They get about 6-7 hours of sun. During heavy rains, they take a pounding from water coming off the roof that the gutters miss. Are there appropriate flowers that have a high tolerance for abuse?
That's a really good question. That might be more abuse than any plant could really take. You know, because if you're doing anything edible in there, it's going to be supple. If you're just doing flowers in there, then you're going to have a really thick planting. But unfortunately, I just even plants that are in the ground, when you have a gutter that's not working right and it's smacking the ground, you will see that plant, even a shrub, is going to eventually not like it at all. So I would say, Let's see if we can move the window boxes or fix the gutter.
Yeah, fix the gutter. Marigolds, might marigolds work in there?
They might, but if the rain is good enough, it could just, you know, marigolds are nice and stiff, but if it's a big rain, they could snap.
Yeah.
You know, so I was thinking things like, you know, maybe something like petunias or portulaca or scavola, you know, because they're already kind of lying on the ground.
Yeah.
You know, so they may take it, but I'm telling you, that may be one of those like trial and error type things. Trial and succeed, hopefully.
Trial and succeed would be, that's
the
plan anyway. Oh, man.
Sorry, Pat.
Oh, man. Someone else wondered what kind of fertilizer should you use when adding food plants to your landscape? You've kind of covered this a little bit.
I did, yeah, and I happen to really like Neptune's Harvest. We've used that a lot. I just bought a really big tub of Regenesis bioinoculant, and if you watch that movie, The Need to Grow by the Food Revolution Network, they talk a lot about this Regenesis soil, and now you're dealing with adding algae and all sorts of really great bioavailable nutrients to stimulate the biology that you have in your soil. And really what you want to remember is that you're trying to build soil so that your soil feeds the plants over you feeding the plants, if that makes sense. And that's a long game. That's, you know, not one feeding. It's a constant annual, let me give a little bit of a boost to my soil.
Yeah. Fred in New Berlin has something for us. Fred, hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, what's on your mind today?
Back in the early 60s when I built our house, it was standard mixture with the plant to lawn to use bluegrass, rye, and white clover. And I noticed where the white clover survived, that is my best lawn. So I was wondering what variety of white clover I should buy.
White clover, it does insert a little nitrogen into the soil, which is a good thing, and that's probably why the other grass goes so well.
Yeah,
Monique,
I've been using Dutch white clover. It's a little bit taller, so that if you're growing your Kentucky and rye grasses a little taller, the clover can stand up to it.
If you're growing a shorter grass, you could use, I think it's Ladino clover, which is very, very low, much lower to the ground. I've just started, believe it or not, using fescue and clover mix that's available as a sod in my area, and you can pop onto sodco.com and read about it. I also use their Black Beauty Tall Fescue, which really is one of my favorites. It's just so robust, but they actually figured out how to do a sod with micro clover in it. So you may not be able to source it in your area, but you could do some research there and then see if there's someone in your area that's doing the same thing. They can't be the only people doing it.
Yeah, you know, clover's starting to come back a bit now. It used to be in every lawn mix, and now we're starting to see more of it as people kind of want to save a little, eliminate some fertilizing that they may have to do with their lawn, and also for the insects.
Yeah, I think we're definitely wising up. You know, as a people as a whole, we're starting to realize that synthetic chemical applications are, they're like a Snickers bar, right? Great quick fix, but doesn't do anything in the long term. So when we think about drought tolerance in our lawns, and we also think about that action of nitrogen fixing, pulling atmospheric nitrogen and bringing it down into the soil, that it's just smart. And I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. Fred, thanks again. Well, Tom in Wauwatosa, your turn now. Hi, Tom.
Hey, so I got a couple of quick natural tips that I've come across. Number one for fertilizing plants, a good one is worm castings. Some garden centers sell it in bags, but raking that in, it makes an excellent natural fertilizer. For anybody who's dealing with dead rings underneath pine trees, if they buy some bags of crushed lime and rake it in, you can plant flowers underneath a pine tree literally that same year. And for dealing with pesky critters gnawing on stuff that you might want to keep away, if you take and go to any barber shop and get some short hair clippings, they don't like when they step on the prickly hairs. They can feel it through their paws, and that'll help keep away rabbits and squirrels and chipmunks and so on.
All right, Monique.
That's fabulous. All I could think of is I'm going to go to the local barber shop when they open back up and say, just give me a bag, right? Because I'll be putting that everywhere. I've definitely used the lime tip, and I think that that's a great idea. And what I would just kind of push on a little bit with that one is there are also plants that will grow under pines that actually like the same acidic nature of the soil. So trying to go for, like, what do the pines like, and plants that will cohabitate nicely. You know, like if you wanted to plant low bush blueberry, makes a nice elevated ground cover, but also likes being under a pine. So always try to help people to choose plant companions based on their soil preferences and their water level preferences, so that they can share the same niche with not a lot of work on our part. And then the worm castings is an awesome idea. As a professional gardener, we don't use them very much. It's just not as cost effective. But for home gardening, I would say absolutely, Tom, spot on with that one. Yep.
Tom, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. I want to go back to your book for just a minute. You know, the book, it's titled Stop Landscaping, Start Livescaping, and you have a nice style, writing style, by the way, Monique.
Thank you.
It makes it, your style makes for fun reading. What do you hope people will take away from that book?
I think the main thing I want them to take away is that they can do it. That you know, I think on some level, our ability to dream about and make changes in our landscape so that they are more comfortable and soul fulfilling. I think that's within everybody's ability. Now, I'm not saying it's within everybody's physical ability, but it's certainly within everybody's ability
to have that in varying degree. And I'm trying very hard to move us away from pretty, the pretty picture we see in a magazine or the end result on a TV show, but rather move us closer to satisfying and fulfilling, and that they're all pretty is in the eye of the beholder. So somebody might have their whole front garden done up with edible plants and medicinal. I don't want to forget the medicinal plants and the herbs, the berries, fruit trees, and it will not be the picture of suburbia, but it will be healthy, and it may be really soul fulfilling for that person. So my hope is that when I say stop landscaping, I'm really saying stop going for just the look, and start landscaping instead. Go for what is just really embracing to live in.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned medicinal plants. What of those plants are favorites of yours?
So I studied medicinal herbs for about 5 years, and I was really, really interested in herbs that would curb things like headaches, would soothe stress and nervousness, that would also be really good for asthma. And mostly I was pushing toward herbs that were immune builders. So I have a whole garden that is a pollinator / medicinal garden. And I have to say, I don't harvest as much as I used to when my kids were little. But, you know, I have things like feverfew and chamomile. And then I'll work in basil and fennel. And then I have echinacea and elecampane. And these flowers are just so beautiful. The plants are so beautiful. And I can stand in that garden in the middle of the summer and just stay still. And the amount of pollinators buzzing around me is astounding. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether you're making teas, whether you're making stews with lemongrass, whether you're making teas with chamomile, these are such easy things to grow. And if you just happen not to harvest, they're also beautiful.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. We had someone else who couldn't stay on, but has a front porch and likes to sit on the porch. And I like this, too, as a matter of fact, wondering about plants that will give a great aroma in the late afternoon when it's time for a beer or a glass of wine on the front porch.
Yeah, so I love good smells in the garden. And the key with garden smells is to think about the seasons, right? So here I love to incorporate things like lilac. And if you don't have room for big lilacs, you can use the small dwarf Korean. They are definitely a cultivar, and they may not be native in your area, but they're not negative plants. They're not bad plants. The pollinators like them. I work with viburnums, which they're Korean spice viburnum, or the snowball, Japanese snowball viburnum. The smell rivals lilacs, and also clethra. So in my area, clethra or summer sweet is a native, and there are some great cultivars of clethra that are a little smaller than the ones we find in the wild. And that fragrance in the summertime, if you're out on your porch in August and you want to go out there and have a beer, I tell you, the smell is just so sweet and subtle. And you don't have to plant it right at your porch, but plant it, you know, if you know where the winds are, plant it so that you're sitting downwind. And let me tell you, you are going to be one happy person.
Yep. It's great to think about sitting out on the porch with a glass of wine and those great smells coming in, aromas
yeah.
coming in from your plants. It's just absolutely amazing. Well, tell us about your website, thegardencontinuum.com.
So my website is a really interactive website, and I hope your audience will enjoy it. I have a blog. It's free. You can sign up and just enjoy all the articles. I love what I do, if you haven't figured that out. It's been a lifetime, and I'm sort of bubbling over with information, and I thought, well, I've got to just share this. So I decided that a blog was the way to do it. My latest blog is Why Now is the Time to Create a Home Vegetable Garden. But I've got blogs on how to weed, on how to deadhead a salvia and deadhead your daylilies. And there's a companion YouTube channel. So with how to weed or how to deadhead, I'm actually physically showing you on video how to do it. So I really hope people will take a look at it and just feel more empowered to garden for themselves. And then I also do a business blog for the people, your callers, you know, like your very first caller, Marcus, who was doing remodeling and landscaping. I have a lot on there about running a contracting business, especially running a landscape business, how we deal with everything from putting in safety measures for COVID-19 to recruiting and onboarding employees. So I hope, you know, your listeners will see it as a really good resource, a go-to resource to just get better at what they're doing for themselves.
Well, I tell you what, it's been a lot of fun. By the way, one quick question here from Veronica. How do you suggestions for a natural looking fire pit, not like the above ground versions?
Oh, Veronica, thank you. You just made my day. So one of the things I talk about in the book is avoiding what I call featurescaping, which is, you know, taking one feature after another and popping it into the landscape. I love the what I call campfire. And I actually have to get that up on my portfolio page, and I promise I will do that. But it's taking really beautiful boulders from your area, so things that look like they're from your area, digging a bit of a pit, filling the pit with stone, and then placing really nicely these boulders around, nice and wide, so that you can absolutely have a raging bonfire there if you want, or a small fire. But the great thing is there's no mortar. There's no cracking stones. It's really inviting. And I would say, oh, my gosh, anybody can build that.
I love it. Oh, Monique, it's been a joy talking with you today. I hope we have a chance to do this again. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I would love to talk to you again. Really a lot of fun.
Monique Allen. Her new book is called Stop Landscaping, Start Lifescaping. And the website she was just talking about is thegardencontinuum.com. Take a look there as well. Great to have her with us. Hey, have a great weekend, but stick around. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.